1974 on the YSU campus. Interviews with Roger Cossett and Lou DiRinato. Roger Cossett was the interviewee, and Lou DiRinato was the interviewer. And the subject of the discussion is our involvement in Vietnam, and specifically Roger's involvement there. And Roger, I just need a little bit of background on you, where you went to high school, where you were born.
Okay, born in Youngstown, Ohio. Went to school at Grand High, Youngstown, Ohio. Born October 3rd, 1949.
Okay, that's, well, I was born on the 6th, October 49. Roger, when, approximately when did you enter the Army?
Went in May of 1969.
And were you drafted, or?
Yeah, I was drafted out of school. I was going full-time to school, and I was still drafted. For that time, it seemed they were using obscure draft laws, and they got a lot of people that were in school. I was caught in some technicality, so to try to stay out of going infantry, which a lot of people were going to at that time, I took an extra year in intelligence.
Well, this option was given to you as an enlistment?
Yeah, after the test and everything. I took, I scored high enough to I could have something, so I took an extra year.
What was your major in?
I was accounting when I was in before. Now it's philosophy.
You know, upon this, getting the draft notice and all that kind of thing, what was your initial reaction?
The initial reaction was, that I had gotten nailed and all that stuff. And there wasn't really much thought in any given direction. Sort of accepted it and went.
Where did you take basic command?
Took it down to Fort Campbell, Kentucky.
That's a pleasant place, isn't it?
Yeah.
How about when you first entered the Army? Did you have any preconceived notions about the military and...
Not really preconceived. I figured, something I didn't really want to be in, but I went. I didn't have that strong of a feeling, like, any which way, for or against the Army or the war or anything else. Sort of didn't like the idea of the war, that is, but that's about as far as it went. I had nothing. There was no set political feelings here.
Yeah. Okay, I understand you went to military intelligence from this school.
It was in Baltimore.
And how long did this go on?
I was there for like that. 2 or 3 months or so, something like that.
And then what happened?
I immediately went to Vietnam.
Did you? Oh, man. Did this training you received there in Vietnam, did it prepare you at all for, or not in Vietnam, the training in Baltimore prepare you at all for what happened in Vietnam?
Not really. Most of the stuff you got there was nice to know stuff. You sort of had to pick up what you did when you got there, because when our people got there, they scattered all over the country, and a lot of us ended up doing stuff they never did before. I had the same thing. I didn't even learn what I did when I was over there. Like, my job in Nam was completely different than my training.
How about your orders for Vietnam? When you got those, was there any attempt to get out of the orders, or did you just...
No attempt to get out.
Okay. Were you, are you married? Or...
No.
Okay. Where were you stationed there in Vietnam?
I was stationed in a little place called Bin Loi in 3 Corps. It was between Saigon and Long Bin. It was like an ammo dump there, and the only bridge crossing the river for like about 20 miles either way. So it was, well, the ammo dump was a Vietnamese ammo dump, and the bridge was controlled by the South Vietnamese.
Did you work go ahead.
Oh, okay, I worked like in a combined intelligence thing. Our situation was strange. Like, our main office was in what was called JGS compound, Joint General Staff. And it's like the equivalent of the South Vietnamese Pentagon. And we had our own building inside of the compound, completely fenced off with machine gun towers. There was one road leading in and out of it. It was like mined the whole way down, tanks, machine guns. So the whole thing that That stuff came up after Tet of 68, but they moved it in a real secure place. And it was a combined thing with Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, and the South Vietnamese. So we worked with everybody. And it was unique. While we worked in an office and had air conditioning and the whole thing, our people also ended up out in the field too. Like when information would break down, our people would have to go out and straighten the stuff out. And so we had people all the way from in the rice paddies up in the air conditioned office and all through the chain of command down there. So we were never stationary in one spot. We'd do our paperwork then, we'd have to go out.
Oh, so you both worked in the office, and then you also
And out in the field too.
Out in the field.
And we also lived in. It was funny. We were one of the few places USO shows refused to come to. Our place was horrible.
Really?
We had no water for a lot of the times. They had a truck water in from Longman every now and then. Showers didn't work. We were right on the river, so. Like when the river would go up and down, it was affected by the tides, and during the monsoons and stuff, our compound would get flooded and stuff. So it was definitely a whole. We had a lot of people. They used to try everything they could never to come back to the compound. They used to sleep right at work on the floor and stuff because they just didn't want to come back to the compound.
Man, those are really some terrible conditions. What about what kind of barracks are these now? Are they regular?
They were. Okay. Open screen barracks that had slats on the side for the vents, so like the rain wouldn't come through. They were angled, you know, but like, the air would come through and stuff. And where we were, it was originally a French estate of some sort, and we were like on the main compound where the estate was. So the main house was like the orderly room where the officers lived and everything. And they had converted some of the buildings, like the old stables, into barracks, or some of the people slept in. They called it the barn. And I had our barracks was right in the back on the river by the fence. So we were at the very end of the compound. Compound was small, taking me about a minute and a half to walk from one to the other. And just a small place, strictly living and nothing else.
What kind of, did they have any kind of recreation facilities where you were?
They had built a handball court there. They put up a basketball court. Well, that was like, kind of broken concrete and stuff by now. And that's as far as that stuff. When they have their own club, they serve like warm beer and drinks and stuff there. They showed movies in there, but that was just sort of like an extra place to go. That was about it.
How about, were there separate places for the officers too? Or just?
Yeah. Well, we only had like one, about four or five officers on. That kind of, it was just, they ran the company. That we weren't broken up into the traditional, companies, platoons, and all that stuff. Like, it was, the compound was strictly a living arrangement. The only permanent people that were there all the time were like the people that worked in the orderly room and the security force that actually stayed and worked on the compound. Everybody else went out to the different centers and stuff, and they traveled around. So, like, we were sort of apart from the structured army thing.
Now, when did you about get to Vietnam?
I got to Vietnam in November. It was November the 13th, 1969.
These dates are pretty well
yeah.
in your mind, huh? And then you're due to rotate back within 12 months, is it? Or 13?
Yeah, I got a 2-week drop when I was home on Halloween in 1970.
How about now? As far as R&R goes and that kind of thing that we hear.
I spent 1 week in Australia.
And that was it?
That was it. The only time I was out of the country.
When does this R&R type deal come up?
When you're on your first tour, like a lot of it depends where you want to go. If you want to go to Hawaii, you usually have to be married and you're going to meet your wife over there. Like it's hard to get to Hawaii any other way. Australia is the next important spot that people want to go to, and you usually have to be in country like at least 10 months. Getting R&R before 10 months in Australia is almost impossible. It's done occasionally, but rarely. It would be done with someone who was actually working in the offices processing the papers and they get their own stuff in. I saw that you had to almost be out of Vietnam before you could get to Australia.
And then,
And then they had Taipei and Bangkok and stuff. You could hit those like after about 6-7 months if you wanted. Plus, you had the option on your first tour there of taking 7 days leave out of your own time extra if you wanted. And if you extended for 6 months, each 6 months tour that you took, you had an additional R&R and leave with it if you wanted.
How about you now? What was your specific job or can?
Okay, my specific job was keeping track of the names, the locations, the sizes, last contact, everything of all North Vietnamese and our Viet Cong units in South Vietnam, North Vietnam, and all border units, which is 15 kilometers inside of Cambodia and Laos. I kept our names of the commanders, deputy commanders, and maybe one other officer or a higher ranking enlisted man if they were available. And it was our job to like know where all the units were, what they were doing, like how they were acting, like if they were on the move, what their plan of attacks were and stuff.
How did you get the information? Call them? Or?
No, the information came in from the field and be picked up by agents, field, meaning usually the local Vietnamese that were working for the Americans or the combat units. It would be, we never handled documents. We had a documents division in another part of the city, and they'd get the documents, translate them and everything, and then they mail the information out to the different centers, and if you needed the information, you had it.
You were over there then during the Cambodian invasion?
Yeah, Cambodia was what, March, I think, or whatever. Okay, I got there, like I said, in November, and around December, I'd only been there a month. I was just starting to learn my job, and a big flap came in that they wanted all information on Cambodia that we had, and I think we worked something like 3 solid days and nights continuously around the clock. We never left the thing. We slept there, the food was brought in and everything, and we knew like in December something was going to happen in Cambodia. And as it got closer, we knew that they were going into Cambodia. And like that's funny too, because say maybe about a month after Cambodia, a document was sent in to our building where we were, and it was so long as you know papers go, and it was diagrammed. The entire inside of our building was outlined where all the offices were, where the arms rooms were, what each office was, and on the inside of each office there was little squares where the desks were, our safes, filing cabinets, everything, and they had all the names up to like about 2 weeks. You know, that it was like at the most, there might have been 1 or 2 people that left and, you know, someone had come in and replace it. But they had the whole inside of our intelligence operation mapped out and plotted and everything. And one of the reasons they did go into Cambodia was to stop an invasion that was coming with the supplies and everything. It would have probably been at least another Tet of 68 and maybe even worse.
So, according to your the information you had, you probably think that the Cambodian invasion was justified?
Well, if you want to put it in practical army terms, yes, but if you start getting into the whole involvement, then like, we shouldn't have even been over there in the first place. So I've been able to get a division in mind, but like, I can talk about something being right and wrong and also being practical and impractical. Like, if I talk about something, say that the Army did, I could talk about it in their terms and understand why they did it, but I don't have to accept it, which I usually don't.
Okay. Did you have much contact with, well, you must have a lot of contact with the South Vietnamese and so on.
Yeah. In fact, where we lived, we were the only American unit around. All the other American units had pulled out, and the whole area was left under the control of the South Vietnamese.
What was, your reaction to them, or what you thought their reaction to you?
reaction in general was that the South Vietnamese were fucked. That's all you can say. You had no respect for them as, say, a fighting man or anything like that. Again, like I said, there's that point, and, you know, I sort of try to see it from their point. They had a whole new way of technology and everything thrown on. So they're like, it's like we used to see them, say they dig a ditch to lay a pipe or something and fill it over, and so the ditch would cave in if the heavy equipment went over and they'd lose the stuff. Or if they build, but it was more than that. I've seen when they built their houses and stuff, like the shacks they put up in the area, it'd be lopsided and they'd fall down and stuff. It just seemed like it was a very backwards country, and I always had a feeling that they weren't always like that, but they were being forced into a new way of life. Like right now, if say you were thrown out in the street, and anything you can get on your own, you could use to build a house with anything, but you couldn't buy anything because you didn't have any money, none of the supplies were available. So they'd make stuff out of, they'd collect beer cans and put them open and lay the stuff flat and build houses out of that, or crates, you know, the whole type of thing. And it seems like they could never quite master the technical aspects of anything. And I don't know that much, just an observation. I don't know the whys or anything, why they couldn't. But as much as I tried to see them in the light of, you know, a strange environment, being war and everything, I always had this feeling, you know, that they were dumb, really. And as much as you know, say it, I always saw them as human beings. I tried never to lose that perspective. But they always seem to me to be very slow in learning anything. Of course, it might have just been a protective thing that they used for their own way of life. I don't know. But. Yeah.
Do you think they liked Americans? Or?
Not really, no. It seemed they were always out to get what they could off the Americans, as having you buy stuff off of them if they own shops and all that stuff, or to have you use your ration cards to get the stuff they couldn't get, like beer, whiskey, cigarettes, food, refrigerators, stereos, TVs, you know, anything. It's funny that anything you had, you can sell in Vietnam easily. You could make money too on the black market too. So it was a thing. You could buy a carton of cigarettes, say for $1.50 in the PX, and you could easily go out and sell them for like 700-800 piastres, which at that time the exchange rate, not the world exchange rate, the exchange rate that was set up between the United States government and South Vietnamese was 118 piastres to one American dollar. I think it was something like, on the world market it was 350 piastres. So the United States had a false exchange rate to bolster the South Vietnamese money. It's like you could probably, on some stuff, you can make like maybe 7-8 times your money if you sold it.
Hmm. What about, you know, when we went there, you know, we were involved in Vietnam. Did you understand why we were there, or did you?
No, I didn't. I changed radically, very radically, from the time I went into the time I got out of Vietnam, and after Vietnam it was even worse. Well, not worse, but it was really extreme as far as the change went. That I went from, I don't know, like right now what I would call a typical apathetic college student or whatever, like I was going to school and I was at, I was, you know, getting a degree to get a job somewhere when I got out, and never really questioned much of anything. I'd say a good example would be that I went, say, from being sympathetic with Wallace's ideas when he was running for president, to a complete reversal of almost believing that the whole concept of government and state wasn't any good at all. People would be a lot better to try it on their own. But I just had a complete radical change in Vietnam. It was started me thinking so much and everything that I just changed completely.
What did it, when did you start noticing this thing?
Okay, where I'd say I noticed it, I think the first time I changed, when I got into basic training, I ran into this guy that was in the SDS. I don't know how the hell they drafted him and caught him, but anyway, he was in basic. And it seemed like every day they'd haul him away for like an hour or two to question him and all that stuff. But, I mean, we talk a little bit, but never anything more than, you know, just normal army talk, like, you know, the whole situation's fucked up. I mean, you know, just the training and everything, kidding around, never got into anything really serious. And maybe after like 2 weeks one day, after we were in basically about 2 weeks, we had a bunch of National Guardsmen training with us around the active duty for training. And they had come from like Mississippi, Florida, the whole way down there. And they were talking about colorings and all that stuff and everything. So I don't know, something clicked between me and the guy that was in the SDS. And without even saying anything to each other, we started pimping these other guys that they were colored too. And they couldn't understand that when we were talking color, we meant the, you know, skin pigmentation and all that stuff. And they kept saying that they weren't colored. And then we were trying to convince them that if they were saying that, they had no color in their skin at all. And that they weren't white. And it just completely blew their mind. And I saw a lot of like prejudice and bigotry and all that right there, and I didn't have a big revelation and said, aha, you know, change and go that way, but it just seemed from then on I always started pimping people a little more, learned to read the regulations and stuff, really didn't give a damn about the training, and then from then on, when we had bayonet drill, at that time it was still Army policy, like, they'd go through the whole thing, like, what's the purpose of the bayonet to kill and all that, which I've heard they've stopped since then.
Yeah, they do.
But we used to yell things out, like someone would yell, what's the purpose of the bayonet? And before the whole crowd could yell out, a couple of us would yell, love. And then, like, everybody would, they'd just freak out, all the lifers would be running around and everything. Nobody knew where it came from. So, you know, we just, every now and then, just keep, like, pimping away. It was probably more about, you know, something that we could get back at the discipline and the training and all that, and how you want us riding, and then just sort of snowballed from there. As I went through intelligence school and started learning more things around here and there, started seeing that, you know, seeing the whole country and army and military and everything sort of paranoid, and it just kept snowballing more and more than Vietnam. When I got back to Baltimore, which we'll probably get into later, found out a lot more stuff about civilian spying and all that stuff. So it just, you know, just kept snowballing.
Paranoia you talk about in the military intelligence, and probably exists a lot in government too. Is it something like to do with they demand so many details for things that
really... No. Okay, I should say me and everyone who was in my field, we had there was a lot more contact between officers and enlisted men and high-ranking officers and enlisted men. Like, it was nothing to sit down in an office like this and talk with a general for about an hour or so. And when I got back from Vietnam, back to Maryland again, I didn't become friends, but I came somewhat close acquaintances with this one lieutenant colonel. And he was sort of like the handpicked boy of the general of the fort there. And before I left, he had made a full bird colonel. And I found he was more explicit about it. But I found his attitude to be this prevalent among higher ranking officers that I had run into and everything. And he was under the impression that the whole country was going down the drain. And the people in Washington and everything, including the president, the Congress, the whole civilian government thing, didn't know what they were doing. And they were saying, like, if we were in Vietnam, they should have let us run it, not, you know, try to control them. They had a big resentment against the government. And he at times actually came out and said that the country would be a lot better off if the military would take over and, you know, just take over the government and run it. And then there was other things like the military training things that they actually have operations going on. They train every month on a theoretical thing where the people go out in the streets and start taking over the government, and the military has to come in and take control of the country again. And that's really freaky when you start thinking, when you tie that in with their civilian, the spying apparatus that the military has on civilians that they were supposed to stop and they never did. And like when they were supposed to destroy the files, all they did was put them on computerized tape and move them. And who, I don't know where they moved them to, but it just, and there was that, and just the general way of life. Like, it was the same thing about the draftees. His view was that the draft should be abolished. This is coming from a high-ranking career officer, that they felt when you drafted, you took people by lot, which is what happened in Vietnam, and you were bringing in too highly of an educated person. Like, he wanted a man that wasn't like me, who could sit down and argue ideas with him. He wanted someone that wouldn't question his orders. He wanted the type of person who really didn't have a home, didn't have a job, had a hard time making it out on the streets. So when he came into the Army, he had a place to sleep, he had clothing, food, you know, the whole thing, and he'd be willing just to follow the orders. And the first thing they wanted was to get rid of the draft. In fact, I'd say there was probably an anti-draft movement among the Army officers long before it came out in the civilian population, especially after they started drafting more people. They just feared the draftee completely. And I couldn't blame them at all from his point of view. And it was funny, by that time, I had formed the opinion that while the draft wasn't good, that it was almost a necessity just for survival of the people in the country. And like now that they have the volunteer army and stuff, I just see more and more of a chance of the military actually trying to take over. Maybe not right now because it hasn't been in long enough and they haven't trained enough. But there's a good chance that the military may try something if things get too bad.
This paranoia you were talking about, was it evident in Vietnam with the officers you had? What was there?
No, I'll tell you, in Vietnam, nobody, like, okay, everyone was there for, you know, what they were doing, but nobody ever bothered the enlisted man. Like, the whole thing with faggings and, you know, shooting and stuff, like, even if nothing happened in your area, they still never rode you, really. Like, it was more of like a half request, half order, if they ever said anything, that they never wanted to really take the chance of pushing someone. Because like in the States where everything, the guns were locked up and stuff, they could always ride you more. Over in Namak, they never knew, you know, who would crack or whatever. So everything, like as long as you did your job, nobody really bothered you that much. There were, it wasn't like you, when you were off duty and stuff, you could again run into the officers or the sergeants that would complain about the anti-war movement, you know, and Congress not letting them run the war the way they wanted to and stuff. But you know, it never went much past the complaining stage and everything. It just normal gripes. Just like maybe we'd have a gripe against the life, or they'd have a gripe against the draft resistor, you know.
This. When you talk about the anti-war movement, were you that much aware of what was going on back here?
Yeah, people knew what was happening. Like, our stuff was never censored coming in, like our mail and stuff. We personally were censored going out and stuff because of where we were. And, if you ever wanted to get an uncensored letter out of the country, like, okay, I had it lucky because my cousin came over, oh, I'd say, maybe about 5 or 6 months after I was in country. So like, I never really had to, but if I wanted to, I could take a letter up to him and have him mail it from Long Bend. Since he was just a clerk in a medical outfit, like, they never censored his mail, so if I wanted to tell anybody something back home, I could always have him mail it.
I didn't realize that they, what that...
Oh, yeah, like, I also learned that if I wanted pictures developed, but I had a camera, but I wasn't in developing over there, that if I wanted stuff developed, I was willing to lose some of the quality of the picture and take it to a Vietnamese photography studio. Because I forget exactly when it happened, but one of the times that the Vietnamese secret police force and everything stormed their parliament building, or whatever the representative building was, and they took out like about 10 or so elected officials and threw them in jail, and they were never heard of before, and that's while their Congress was in session. And at that time, the North Vietnamese were offering a peace plan. And the South Vietnamese government just said, we don't even want to hear it. And these people that they arrested were the ones who were saying, well, let's at least hear what they have to say. Like, a lot of them were even strong anti-communists. But they at least wanted to hear what they had to say, just so they could at least say no to proposals instead of just saying no to nothing. And because they wanted to hear what the proposals were, they were arrested. And like, I had been downtown at that time. I had a day off, so I went into town. And I had pictures of, you know, storming a building and everything. And my pictures came back from the developers. All those pictures were gone. So I stopped using the American facilities and used the South Vietnamese. Sacred anything. So, you know, they really didn't know, so.
Did the anti-war movement going on back here, you know, the college students, especially after the Cambodian invasion, because everything went kind of crazy back here, you know, what did you think of it at the time?
Well, because the people around there, a lot of us were wearing black armbands after the people in Kent State got shot and everything, and I had another thing. I had a friend that, before I left for Vietnam, do you know Ronnie Allen?
No.
No, well, he was a history major down here. He's teaching shop now in one of the local junior high schools. But anyway, he's, you know, good making stuff with his hands. And he'll go through phases. Like, he'll find something to do, and he'll make a whole bunch of stuff, and then he'll find another concept to use. But anyway, he was making peace signs out of shoe leather. Get old shoe leather cured and all this stuff soaked. And then he cut out peace signs in it. And he gave me this before I went to Vietnam. And the only time I ever took it off my neck at all was to take a shower, and it stayed right there with me. When I got done, I put it back on. And a lot of the officers and stuff used to get kind of hairy when they saw it, but I never took it off. And I had it till I got back to the States, and I lost it somewhere. But for some reason, I never wanted to take it off, and I would never take it off. But if they ever, when someone would threaten me and say, well, I could always order you to take it off. Now, I knew if they were saying that, they weren't able to do it. Because if they were able to, they would have just ordered me to. So I'd always ask, you know, well, what regulation says you want me to take that off, blah, blah, et cetera, et cetera. And no, I just never took it off. And I just sort of became very attached to it. It was, well, half for what it stood for, it's a peace symbol, and half is a personal gift from a friend, so. I don't know if you want to count that as part of the anti-war movement in Vietnam, but I mean, it was very high. A lot of people would purposely screw up things, even in Vietnam or back in Baltimore, anywhere, you know, just because the army was doing it, and they thought it was some way to get back while they were into it. Which is why I could relate somewhat to all this sabotage that they had like a year or so ago on the Navy ships and stuff. But, like, a lot of that happens, it never gets out in the papers anyway. Like, a lot of stuff happens, I know it never got out in the papers.
Yeah. I wanted to ask something that just kind of slipped my mind there. Oh, what kind of rapport was there between the officers and the enlisted men?
Okay. It depended on who the officer was. I'd say about 80% or so would have the attitude, I'm the officer, you're the enlisted man. There was this major in our office who was the opposite of that. He used to come in and say, I need a driver to take me up to headquarters or over to MACV or whatever, and everybody would always volunteer. Because whenever he was going over, he'd drive himself. So then when he wanted a driver, like maybe you drive out to Tonsonute Air Base and, his hobby was airplanes. So he used to like to sit there and watch the planes come in and identify them on the way, and he could tell you all this stuff about some of their history, some of their capabilities and stuff. And, he was sort of, I guess you would call him anti-war officer, because when Vietnam broke out early 64, 65 or something out through there, he had been out of the service, and they called him back into the service. He had set up a business and everything. He had finally settled down, and he sort of resented the fact that the military called him back in, which made me glad that I turned down officers' training school and was offered to me before. But, I heard that before, so I made sure I wouldn't take it, because once you become an officer, they can bring you back in anytime they want to, if it's deemed necessary. So. He was a fairly nice guy. In fact, he was the only guy that, as far as I know, he never ordered anybody to do anything and never gave the tone that he was ordering. And he's the only one that I know of that ever had everything done that he wanted. But he had the idea that, it's a job and we're both stuck here, so we might as well make the best of it. And he had no false things of rank or anything. It would sort of be like right now, if you could sit down and talk to a professor that's a good friend of yours or something, that even though he's a professor and you're the student, there's really no division at all. But basically, every now and then you run in there, you'd be walking down the road somewhere and you walk past an officer without saluting. And he'd call you back and give you a 5-minute lecture about saluting and everything, and so with you just turn around and walk away without saluting him again. Some of them were still into the saluting thing and everything. And then you could always come back saying, you didn't salute him, because if there was a sniper around, that he saw you saluting the other guy, he might shoot him. So you were actually saving his life from not saluting. And then I could go nuts when you started pulling stuff like that, It was just a big joke.
As a means of helping you pass your time.
Yeah, you always found ways to harass them and stuff.
How about the time you spent in the field? How was this?
When the stuff was spent out in the field, it was always, you usually know ahead of time if something was coming. So what would happen is the longer you were there, the quicker you disappeared. And when it was time to go out in the field, everyone would just sort of move away. And the one person who was stuck around would get to go, so they tried to stay out of the field. And when you went, the thing you do is you get in a helicopter if you're going closer, or if it was further away, you get in a transport and they take you out. And then you just try to get the information you needed or fix up the thing that was going wrong, a flow of information, and get out quick. It's you never wanted to stay in an area, because when you were out where the information was coming in from, you were in the combat zone and stuff. And, you were always at a disadvantage when you went out, because you never knew the area, you never knew the people, you never knew anything was going on in the area. So, you wouldn't know how the VC or the NVA would work their ambushes or when they'd attack. So, it was an idea, if you landed, you were coming in a jeep into the compound, and you're coming in at the time of day that they always have a rocket attack on the compound. You wouldn't know that before when you came there. So, you were always at a disadvantage when you were out. So the field work was done as quickly as possible to get out of it.
On this field work, you mean they only sent one man?
Well, they'd send one or two guys out, yeah. Depending on what the information was, say from the one source, you had something that had to do with image interpretation and order of battle. Well, you'd send one guy from each section out. But if it only had to do, say, with your section you were in, well, you'd go out and get it done. But like, it seemed you always try to find ways to get out of it. Like, you could always come up with a reason why you should go. And it was usually a team of whoever had the worst reason for wanting to stay had to go. But it was a lot easier just to disappear when it came time to pick someone to go.
No, they didn't have any set.
No, it wasn't really any set thing. Like, a lot of our people were interchangeable. If one guy was out in the field, someone else would have to do his job for a day or so if they were running around someplace else. So like, we were kind of variable. We could do a number of things.
Kind of jack of all trades, huh?
Yeah. And actually, we had to be a master of what we're doing too. Plus being a jack of everybody else's trade. But you see, that's basically what our training was in or at least that's what they intended it to be in Baltimore, that they sort of exposed you to everything, that you knew what was happening, but the actual work was done when you got to Vietnam, because like nobody in Baltimore knew where you were going, so they couldn't really train you in one specific area. You could get like an MOR, you know what an MRS is?
Right.
Okay, you would train in your MOS field, and you'd become what you were in that field, but you also, you weren't trained totally in that. You had to know everything else, at least be aware of it. So that, say you trained on nothing but learning how to read battle maps and everything and keeping plotting all the movements and all that stuff. Or if they shipped you into a place where you had to interpret photography, you'd be at a complete loss. At least the training, you had a little bit of an idea how to interpret photography, so that when you came, you weren't completely blind and at least have an idea of what you were doing.
Did you have a feeling that you knew what was going on in Vietnam at all times, you know, how deep our involvement was?
Yeah, because with my security clearance and stuff, not even my security clearance, they always left a lot of docs lying around, top secret and all that stuff, so you always read up on things like what we were doing in Laos, what was happening in Cambodia, the different defoliation projects and all that stuff. Things like Eli and stuff, we read the reports on that before they even came out. And like after the big cat flap came out, they had to send people out and compile the reports, so we were reading the reports before they left Vietnam to go back to Washington and all that stuff, so had a fair idea of what was going on in Vietnam.
Did any of these things like My Lai or this defoilage type deal and that kind of thing, did those things shock you? Did you have some idea that they
were happening? Well, you knew they were happening. If you take the thing of My Lai, what I said before about knowing what's right and what's wrong and what's practical in the Army, like as far as Vietnam went, I could understand completely why Cali and his people did what they did at My Lai. I mean, no, it's really anybody would do it in the situation they were in. But it still didn't make it right, and I knew it was wrong. I knew that more than one My Lai happened. So, while I didn't like the idea of it happening, I could understand why they did it.
From the military viewpoint?
Well, not from the military viewpoint, from the personal viewpoint of the people that were there, even though I didn't know them. Like, My Lai, the area of My Lai and Cali people were that the VC unit in that area was not strong at all. So they relied almost entirely on booby traps and, you know, all that stuff. So it would be a bit that, let's say you took 30 people that you know real close and they're your friends, and they're the only 30 people in the area that you know. And every day you had to go out. And you knew when you were going out that you were going to run into booby traps. And like almost every day someone would get shot with a bullet that was put in the booby trap or they get their leg blown off. You know, just something like that. And no matter what you did, you knew you were never going to see the Viet Cong, but they just weren't there because they couldn't patrol area. So that after you're doing this month after month after month, it really gets to you. And the only thing you start thinking of is if, at least if you had a chance to fight and shoot at him, you know, at least you stand a chance more than these booby traps. It's a very great psychological thing. So like with all this stuff, so, like, with all this happening, the pressure is really built up on Callahan's people. So, when the chance popped up that they did run into a VC, I think it was just one or two of them they ran into. It happened to be a thing. They were walking, you know, one way, and Callahan's people sort of came into them. So, you know, here was the chance. So, you know, they started shooting. And it just so happened that Kelly and his people were walking towards Milai. And, naturally, when you see someone shooting at you, you're going to run the other way. That's the quickest way out, away from them. So they ran towards Milai. Now, whether they were actually based in Milai or what, I don't know. Never found that out. But they just ran in that area. So Callie and his people went charging out after him, and it might have been known throughout the whole command of Callie's people that, you know, you just, you know, when you find them, just shoot them, because, you know, they were really tearing up your outfit and everything. So Callie could have mistaken the thing that he was under orders to wipe out the village, or it could have been the thing that, you know, when you find out where they're at, wipe them out. And they evidently thought that Milai was where they were based. So they just went in guns blazing, and, you know, like they weren't going to take the chance. Like, you figure you finally got the people that have been killing and maiming your buddies, you know, for months on end. So you just, and you weren't going to take the chance. You know, that they weren't VC, you know, as far as you knew they were in the air. So it's just a combination of all the psychological factors building up, and they went right in and did it. Okay, so from that aspect, I could see why they did it. Then you have to start getting into the whole thing from the government, the United States government, all the way down to the military, into Vietnam, and everything, that happened because of our involvement over there, and that there was no reason for us to be in Vietnam. And that they sort of forced, well, the people who were there were forced to survive the way they could. And, that while Kelly and his people should have been tried, and while Kelly was and everybody else that were involved in it, I think should have been tried and found guilty in the whole thing, it should have gone higher too. It should have gone back into the government of the United States. And all of them should have been nailed for Milai's and all the stuff that happened over there. But it shouldn't have just stopped with Kelly. They should have nailed everybody all the way out. And at the same time, I think I was wrong too for going, and I shouldn't have gone. And,
why is that?
Now I should have gone to Canada. I should have just refused to go. And first, that would have been, I feel, the right thing for me to do. And, I would have to say now that, okay, again, it would be hard to say who would try you or anything, but I would have to morally be willing to stand trial too for anything that I did, which someone might consider a war crime or anything. I don't never really did anything that I consider a war crime. I purposely tried to do as little as possible in everything, in the work that I did, and in any actions that I did that. You know, I realized that my enemy wasn't the people of South Vietnam, or I should say the people of Vietnam, because I don't really recognize the division between North and South Vietnam. North and South Vietnam is a political division that I feel has been created by Western influence. And it's strictly an arbitrary line drawn from some people 10,000 miles away. And I just can't justify anything happening over there. And I still can't justify any aid they may be sending over now.
What about the people of Vietnam, of South Vietnam, are these the people, do you think those people want us there?
No, they don't. Like I said, I ran into a lot of stuff that was never published. And the Army was going to do a real nice survey for the South Vietnamese government. And they sent people out in their fields and stuff all over the country. And they were polling the people for the support of Chiu and the Saigon government and everything. And they found out that 85% of the people interviewed that were supposedly in South Vietnamese controlled territory and everything did not support the South Vietnamese government. They thought it was corrupt and everything. And they wanted the United States out, they wanted the government out, and all they wanted to do was to farm their lands and stuff.
They're just more concerned with peace.
Yeah, they were more concerned with peace and getting rid of all these white people that come around bombing their villages and ruining their crops and everything.
How about Ho Chi Minh? How do they look on him? How do you view
him? I don't know how they look on him. I view Ho Chi Minh, I'd say on the same level that I look at, say, Mao and Che Guevara, that they were people that felt that they were doing what they could for their country, like that there was an invasion, a foreign power oppressing their people, whether the French, the United States, anybody was in China or Cuba or Vietnam, anywhere in there, that there was this Western influence that was oppressing their people, using their own people to fight against their own people and to police their own people, destroying their country. And they felt that they had to go out and do something about it and try to free their people. And they just couldn't passively sit by and let a foreign power take them over. So I look at them as more as patriots for their own country.
How about Tu?
He's a power and dictator. I mean, South Vietnam is a military dictatorship. It's apparent that there's arrests in the street, people are clubbed in the streets, they're shot in the streets. People don't speak out against the government and anything. So, I mean, like, there was I'd say maybe a couple hundred meters away from the front gate of our compound where we work in JGS, there were some Vietnamese war veterans who were wounded, like a lot of them had legs and arms blown off and all this stuff. And there was an empty tract of land that they wanted to build shacks on to live in, like nobody was using the land. They had sort of set up like a squatter's village and stuff, and they just, you know, wanted to put up their stuff so they were in Saigon so they could, you know, try to get jobs or beg, whatever they wanted to do, but they had a place to live. And like the riot police and the military were sent in and everything, and they were like gassed, clubbed, shot and everything, arrested. And like, it was nothing to have people come back in from work at lunchtime coughing with tear gas and everything because they were, you know, gassing the riot and all that stuff. That it's a pure hardcore police state. And no one is going to tell me any different that they're just using, you know, they're in an emergency and they're using their military powers and stuff. Chiu is a dictator, and he controls the country. He controls the elections. There's no force allowed to run against him. The elections are rigged. And it was known. And, like, that started making me think more about the United States government. And I started looking at things like, you look at the Philippines, they declared martial law, suspended the Constitution, the United States supports them. South Korea has been under martial law since the 50s. There's really not much freedom there from the people that I've talked that have been in Korea. There's nothing there. They're supported by the United States. The Greek government is a military dictatorship. They're supported by the United States. It seems a lot of the countries that the United States is supporting militarily are all dictatorships. And then you turn back and look at this country and I see the same thing. I've talked to people from Russia, I've talked to people from Greece. But there's these two old people that worked for the McGovern campaign. They came from Greece. I didn't work in the McGovern campaign. I didn't work in any campaign. But their main job, they cooked these elaborate meals for the people that worked on the south side. I think it was on the Market Street headquarters or something by the town. And they were cooking these big Greek meals for the people. And some friends I had always talking about they were going over to dinner at the headquarters and they're having all this stuff. And these people were doing this because they wanted to do something to work for McGovern, because they saw that under Nixon and everything, the way the country was going, that it was turning just into the same thing that they had escaped from in Greece, and they were really scared. And my girlfriend's Russian teacher, she says the same thing, that they're doing the same things here that she saw done in Russia. And she's very paranoid about it. And I just see it. Plus, like I said, what I learned about the military's attitude towards civilians and the spying operations and everything in Baltimore, that, you know, the government seems to be run by paranoid, insane people that view the, well, I mean, I've seen it stated and everything, that the people are to be viewed as an enemy of the government, that they're to be suspecting. There are military spies out still in the area that they send information in there. There's a list of, it's not the White House enemies list. The military keeps a running list of 100,000 people that are considered the top 100,000 subversives. And whenever martial law or whatever they decide to declare as an emergency and it comes into effect, and these people are supposed to be picked up within 6 hours and eventually transported to the Japanese prisoner of war camps that have been renovated and are waiting right now. And then I've also found out that the government and the military view the Vietnam veteran who is out and back on the street as a potential enemy. And if there are two people making a political speech, and they're both saying the same thing, and one happens to be a Vietnam veteran, his chances of being moved in a position to get onto that list of 100,000 people is a lot better than anybody else, because they know that the Vietnam veteran has been trained, he knows all the tricks that the military knows, he knows all the stuff about boot camps. It's like, in my case, I had nothing to do when I was in Vietnam a lot of times, so I got a translated BC handbook on booby traps, and I memorized it. So like, you know, I just know a lot of the booby traps that the Viet Cong use, and I know how to set them and make them and all that stuff. Like, not that I'd ever use it, but it's the idea that they realize that the veteran knows all this, and that there is a big dissatisfaction in this country, which is why, well, okay, nothing that Nixon does surprises me, but when he started, when he wanted to cut the disabled veterans stuff and wanted to cut the GI Bill and everything else, I was wondering what the hell he was doing, because he knew damn well that there's a big difference between, like, the Korean or the World War II veteran and the Vietnam veteran. Like, the Vietnam veteran doesn't have, I feel, this loyal feeling towards the government and stuff that, you know, they said, well, you know, we serve at a time, fine, leave us alone, give us, you know, what we're supposed to get from the GI Bill and everything. We want to go back to our way of life and stuff, and just don't want to be bothered with you anymore. And I think that the Vietnam veteran would react against the government a lot quicker than anybody else would. And the government and the military realizes this, too.
So you think this is one of the reasons he cut the bill, or?
Well, no, like, he started to cut it, but then it wasn't cut. Congress stopped it.
Right.
But like I said, Nixon does crazy things, so you don't know what's happening. But, that's just another thing of the paranoia that's in the government. And like I said, when I was at Holabird, the files were active. We'd run through the files just to see who we could pick up and stuff, and they had congressmen on there, you know, your prominent people in the country, all the files were kept on them, excuse me. Like, the time that the Congress found out about the files the Army was keeping on civilians, we were told that if anybody came nosing around the fort, asking, you know, about the forest, but if they even identified themselves as a congressman and all that, we would just tell them that, you know, we would either work in maintenance or we were just, you know, part of the permanent garrison of the fort and all that stuff, that we didn't have any access to the forest and we didn't know what was happening. But while that was going on, they were taking all the files and computerizing them, putting them on tape and moving them. Where they needed to, we don't know. But the records were never destroyed and the operations were never stopped.
I mean,
the military spying stuff on the civilian population, and like nobody is, you know, excluded from it. I found stuff on my parents, my relatives, my friends, people that had never been in the military. And there were actual records on them and stuff.
You mean just by sending their names through on a computer, or?
Yeah, or like, we could just go to the card file room and we could, you know, sort of, just you pick a name, so you hit the Devo, come to the cards, like, and then you shuffle through till you find the person you're looking for. And I never didn't find anybody I was looking for. I always found their names. So, but then, okay, there was also the other way around with the people that worked there. Like, a lot of people destroyed their own cards, the cards of their friends. So, like, without this card, it was hard to pull the stuff off the tape because you had to move this card through to pull the information off. And so, like, if anything happened, like, they'd tell their friends that, you know, they were in the Army files and stuff. And in the event that in the future, if anything did happen, and say the people didn't get picked up, they knew that there would be a slight snag and, you know, they could split if they had to. Sort of just like, you know, if anything would happen, I'd know enough to leave if I had to, you know, just to be on the safe side.
You mean leave the country?
Well, or leave the country, or just leave the area if I had to, if I was still here. Because, I don't know where my name is. I don't, like, okay, I've written a few letters to the gym. I ran on a student council, you know, said a few things on campus and stuff. And so you don't know who the military informant could be. You, it could be anybody. Like, you know, I don't live in pure paranoia government stuff, but I'm aware that they're there.
Just because of your experience.
Yeah, and they're still functioning and everything. Or it's the same thing like Ray Horn, the guy from the governing campaign that, you know, got on the enemies list from the White House. The only way he could get on the enemies list from this area, doing what he was doing, would be somebody. Okay, Youngstown is basically a dead area as far as revolution or anything goes. But the agents that they have in the area, naturally, they're going to want to, you know, try to keep up the appearance that they're doing their job. So they have to find somebody that's, you know, that they could hand in the name even if they don't get on the list. So naturally, you know, you put in, okay, since McGovern was seen as an enemy of Nixon and of the country and all that from, you know, the re-election point of view, anybody that would run his campaigns had to be a subversive. I mean, you know, the way the logic goes from Washington and everything else. So if you run a local McGovern campaign, eligible to be on the list. So they sent his name in if they couldn't get anybody else's.
What effect did Vietnam have on you coming back to school? When you were there, did you decide, I better go back to school?
No, like that didn't. Right now, the main reason I'm in school is to collect the money on the GI Bill and get whatever training and education I can so I can leave the country. And I'm just interested in ripping them off for what I can and then split. Like, I have no desire to stay in this country at all.
Because
not actually of Vietnam as Vietnam itself, but for what Vietnam did and the reasons behind it, and like what the government and the country has turned into. I sort of see it as like the decline of the empire and the whole thing, and just getting more and more repressive every day. So I've applied for citizenship to Canada. I'm hoping to go up to Canada in about a week or two and start looking for a promise of employment up there. And I'm going to try to get out as soon as I can.
How about the switch in your major? Did that have any...
Well, that When I was over in Vietnam, so I sort of, like, I remember what a county thing was, and then, okay, I'd say I went anti-establishment, which, to stay in with, keep consistent, I'd naturally have to get out of business and get into something else. I'm taking philosophy strictly for my own personal use. I have no intent of getting a job in it. Even I may sometime if I have to. I have no intent of using it strictly for my own use. My minor is sociology. I would like to get something in sociology. I'd like to do my graduate work in Canada in sociology, like make up the hours in sociology that I need to get a major, you know, there, and then finish it off to get a master's up there. Or, right now I'm working at the media center and I'm fairly interested in videotaping, so I wouldn't mind becoming a videotape cameraman either. But like, I have no desire to go back into the economic system of the United States at all. I don't view myself as an American citizen. I view myself as a person that's in this country right now that's, you know, trying to get out. And that's why I can live comfortably on what I do, so I'm not into getting a good job, making good money. As I want to pay as little taxes as possible. I just don't want to leave as quick as I can.
Of course, I could be way off base here. Do you regret then your military experience, or do you think maybe it was enlightening?
Okay, I sort of look, again, there's this fine dividing point that I have in my own mind of almost everything. For what it represented and what it stood for, I'm sort of against it. I'd say now that if I had it to do all over again, I definitely would leave. I'd just go to Canada as quick as I could, if the situation was the same and was easier to get across the border and all that stuff.
But that's in light of what you know about
that's in light of what I know now. I realized very quickly after I got into the service, even before I got to Vietnam, that I shouldn't have gone. But, I don't know, I can't see it as the right move. It was like, you know, okay, you get experience from everything that you do, even if you make a mistake, you learn from it. And I could see it in that respect. But I think it's a very bad mistake. I don't let it bother me. It doesn't keep me up at nights and stuff. But I'm well aware that I made a very bad mistake by going in. And ever since that day, I've tried to talk every person that was going into the National Guard as a reserve or on active duty. I've tried to talk them out of doing it. If they were getting drafted, I told them to go to Canada. Don't be drafted if you could. If they took my advice, fine. They did it wrong. Same thing. If they asked me for my advice, I told them. But I never, you know, I've never forced opinions on anybody. I'm always willing to state them. I'll always, you know, come right out and say what I think. But I never force what I want on anybody.
It must have been pretty tough to, practically the last year and a half of your military experience was after you were in Vietnam, right? And to come back and to adjust to that?
I came back to the States. It was strange. I think my main reaction to it came after I was out of the service. Like, I got out December the 8th of 71, and I got an early out to come back to school. In fact, that's one of the reasons why I also took the extra year, was that there was a chance of getting an early out, so that I actually, you know, spent like extra 6 or 7 months in, instead of the extra whole year. Then I got out, went back to school, and the instant I got out of school, I finished my finals, and the next day, a friend and I, well, we had been planning it since winter, but we got it back, we had all our camping equipment and stuff. We headed up to Canada, and we just went all the way north to Hudson's Bay. We spent a while backpacking, and without coming into towns, it was pure wilderness and stuff. And then we came into a small town, got a canoe there and took a canoe up river to Hudson's Bay. So it was like 1,000 miles north into Canada. We went through the whole summer and we only stopped in like 3 or 4 towns. Had maybe talked to 20 people the whole summer. And I sort of reacted that way, that I got away from everything completely.
Really, that's about all I had to... Do you have any other comments you want to make now about this?
No. I mean, you never said what the main point of the interview was.
It's just to get your reaction.
Just reaction evidence? I'll do that. My reaction, if it was for anything else, I might come up with something else.
Okay. But, thanks a lot, Ryan.
Okay.